Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Change Your Mind podcast, where we explore personal development, spirituality, and science. I'm your host, Chris Ashley. And today we're going to talk about death. And for those of you who have been following me for a while, you know that I have gone down rabbit holes when it comes to reading about near-death experiences and shared death experiences, and I've shared my own experiences with that. So, and we've had a couple death doulas on the show as well. So I think the audience is pretty familiar. We're going to talk about it from a different point of view today, though. So stay tuned. It's going to be a good conversation. First, a couple quick announcements. Head over to the links in the show notes. You are going to find a wealth of information. You will find links for my lovely guest. You will find links to stay connected with me on social media, to buy my book, Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality. It was endorsed by three experts from the film The Secret. It was endorsed by John Gray, who wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. So go check it out. You'll find ways to sponsor the podcast, find free downloads, courses, coaching, all of the good stuff. And as always, this podcast is part of the Los Angeles Tribune Podcast Network. So we are doing a lot in the personal development realm. We have some amazing live events and virtual events coming up. Lots of other cool podcasts in the network. So stay tuned with what we're doing. What if the one thing keeping you stuck is the way you think? Welcome to Change Your Mind with Chris Ashley, the podcast where science meets spirituality. And mindset becomes your most powerful tool for transformation. I'm Chris Ashley, author of Change Your Mind to Change Your Reality, trainer, speaker, and lifelong seeker. For years, I battled trauma, depression, anger, chronic illness, low self-worth, and the weight of old stories. Until I discovered how to rewire my mind, reconnect with my divine nature, and consciously create a new reality from the inside out. This show is here to help you do the same. Each week, we explore the intersection of personal development, spirituality, and science, diving into topics like healing, emotional mastery, entrepreneurship, resilience, and the quantum nature of reality. You'll hear powerful stories, gain practical tools, and real conversations that will help you change your perspective, get unshakable confidence, and live the vision your soul has always known is possible. Whether you're navigating a major life shift, building your dream business, or seeking deep healing and alignment, you're in the right place. So if you're ready to break through, take back your power, and create a life on your terms, this is your moment. Let's break free from the patterns that hold us back, awaken to who we truly are, and rise. Your transformation starts now. All right. So with me today, I have Dr. Kimberly Harms. So Dr. Kim is a renowned, best-selling, award-winning author and international speaker, specializing in grief, conflict resolution, and legacy planning. Dr. Harms has been a dedicated grief counselor, civil mediator, and death doula, offering support and guidance to individuals navigating challenging life transitions. Her multifaceted approach to addressing grief and conflict is informed by her deep understanding of human psychology and her compassionate nature. Dr. Harms is committed to challenging societal norms surrounding death and end-of-life planning. Through her speaking engagements, she endeavors to move audiences beyond the prevalent death-denying culture and empower them to embrace open conversations about mortality. So welcome, Dr. Kim. I'm so happy you're here with me.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I always start all of my episodes the same way, and that is by asking my guests, what is your origin story? So what is it that put you on this path to write several books about death and to be a death doula and someone who's really focusing on this?
Well, I lost both my mother and my son to suicide, which was absolutely shaped my life. I lost my mother the first time to mental illness. She was institutionalized when I was six, and then she took her own life when I was 17. Then I got married to a great guy, had three wonderful children, and then on January 31st of 2009, I lost my amazing son Eric, who was a student at Columbia University. He had just had the best semester ever. This kid was, everything was going well for him. He was a National Merit Scholar. His first semester made the Dean's List. He was elected to student government at Columbia. He was accepted into the jazz program so he could play jazz piano, which was his favorite thing to do. everything was going great. He came back on top of the world after his first semester and went back. And 2 weeks later, 45 minutes after the final breakup with his girlfriend, he took his own life. You know, that impulsive nature of jazz, as a jazz pianist, is impulsive. That's part of what makes him so good. And that brain that was not quite fully formed in the area of critical thinking, he's 19, just was a horrible, fatal cocktail. And our lives just exploded. We could never imagine this. And it just something that we went down deep into that grief pit. And my husband, who had just had a liver transplant 6 months before my son passed away, his heart gave out shortly after my son died. And of course, you don't get a liver if your heart's bad. So they were checking out his heart pretty well before they gave him his liver. And so a year after he had a liver transplant and his heart checked out as great, he was getting set up for quadruple bypass surgery, a valve replacement. And he lived for another 10 years, but was battling heart disease. And I really believe that much of the heart issue was a result of not being treated for depression, which many of us baby boomers failed to do. I, of course, am treated for depression, thankfully. And so I had to spend my life re-identifying myself. When my mother died, I was no longer a daughter. When my son died, I no longer had a son. Husband died, I'm a widow. And I realized I had a wonderful, just one quick story, I had a wonderful, wonderful thing happen to me after my son died. It was about a month or so after my son died. I was a dentist. We were in our office working with my husband. And you're triggered a lot as a dentist. You see a lot of people. They all knew my son. He was well-loved in the community. And so we talked about him all day long, which was hard. And I got out of the office, I was exhausted, and my husband was having a very serious discussion with his cousin right outside the door of our office. And all of a sudden, the cousin turned from my husband, and he came up to me, and he was wagging his finger in my face. And I was shocked because, you know, I was a grieving mother. I wasn't used to this. And he said something to me that really changed my life. He said, "Don't you ever let your remaining children feel that they are not enough. Don't you do that to them."
Yeah.
And it hit me like a lightning bolt, because when you have a catastrophic loss and your world has exploded and you're at the bottom of the grief pit with maybe trying to suck up a little bit of mud, you know, at the bottom, you just can't eat, you can't sleep. Your world has been destroyed. Your worst nightmare is now your reality. When you're in that place, you sometimes, you know, get settled there. And I kind of expected to spend a lot of time at the bottom of the grief pit. And kind of thinking, well, why get out if you're just going to get pushed back down again? Because we've had some traumatic years.
Yeah.
But I realized at that moment that I couldn't do that, because I had two daughters that I love so much and my husband who I loved, and they were suffering too. And I realized that the grief that I had would affect their grief. My husband's cousin felt that he lost his parents at the same time as he lost his brother, because he lost his brother when he was young. And I was determined not to do that to my children. So that was a moment that forced me to think beyond myself, to realize what my grief was doing to other people, and forced me to fight, kick, claw my way out of that grief pit to get to a point where, you know, I can breathe fresh air again. It wasn't easy, took years, but I just want to recommend to everyone who's out there that's going through a catastrophic loss that it is totally worth it to do the work necessary, because it's a lot of work, and take the time necessary to climb out of that pit, because the air is a lot better up here.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing your story. I'm like over here tearing up as you're talking. That's so devastating. And I'm, you know, we talk a lot about on the show that, like, you know, things happen for a reason and you can like grow from things, but like, that is just like so heartbreaking to lose a child. And I'm really sorry that you went through that. And I'm grateful for the work that you're out there doing right now. And, you know, I have heard similar things of people I know actually, who have lost siblings, some actually to suicide, some to drug overdoses, where they felt like they lost their parents too. And it destroys families, and couples often split up, and it's the other kids have to grow up quickly if they're younger. And it's pretty amazing that you got that wake up call, even if in the moment it was like very off-putting. So I know that there's not a simple answer, but how did you get out of that grief pit? Like, where did you even turn, or like, what was the most helpful thing?
Well, interestingly enough, a year after my son died, we were going through some, I lost my brother, my husband had cancer, my son died. And then a year after my son died, I developed nerve damage in my drilling fingers. I'm a dentist. So I was at the Mayo Clinic a year after my son died. I was also the major support for my family since my husband was still ill. He was recovering from liver cancer and liver transplant. So I lost my profession, and I was president of the Dental Association a few years back here in Minnesota. It was a big identity for me.
Yeah.
And that was gone too. And one day that was gone. So I had a little time on my hands. So I decided to study to be a grief counselor. So I did. And as I was studying to be a grief counselor, I came across something that just struck me that not a lot of people talk about. We hear a lot about the stages of grief, the Kubler-Ross stages of grief. I think most people know that. But a man named Worden created the tasks of mourning. And I like tasks because tasks think, makes you think I have to do something.
I could check that off my list.
Yeah. I can work at it, right? Stages are like, I go through, I'm in this stage now, but task to me is something I can grab onto.
Okay.
And it made a lot of sense to me. And he had four tasks of mourning. The first task was acceptance, which is Kubler-Ross's last task of grief, interestingly enough. Mm. Accepting the loss, which is really hard when you've lost a loved one, to just accept that he's gone. He's gone. I can't do anything to get him back. He's gone. So the first task is acceptance. The second task is processing the grief. Oh, that's the hard part. When you go through something like that, I kind of wanted to be like Rip Van Winkle and just go to sleep and wake up in 20 years and I'd be okay again, right? But even if I woke up in 20 years, I wouldn't be okay again, because you have to process the grief. You have to work through it. It's hard. It's painful, but it can be done. It takes work. It takes a lot of work. And so I kind of grabbed onto that. The next stage is coming to terms with your new reality, which you do as a mother that's lost a child, and particularly as a widow, when all of a sudden you're not even part of a couple anymore and you're living alone. I got married at 19. I was married for 44 years. And now I'm alone. Nobody knows if I go to the grocery store or where I'm at. It's a whole new thing to be a widow and to be alone. And 75% of married women become widows because the men tend to go first. So a lot of us are going to face that. And then the last task is to find a place for your loved one in your heart, and where you can think about your loved one, talk about your loved one in a way that does not affect how you view the rest of the world. So basically it's removing that shroud. Anyone that's been through grief, you kind of know, you see the world through a shroud. You're kind of like a zombie. You're like dead on the inside. And you're just trying to focus on the outside. So the end result, there is an end result. There's a goal. There's a goal to these tasks. And that is to find that place for your loved one in a way that allows you to live in the moment and be there for the people around you. And I just love that model. And I kind of clung to that model. And it worked for me. And that has been helpful. It's helpful for me to set a goal and to know where I'm going.
I love that so much. And I'm over here like tearing up. I have to just like tell you, this conversation's coming at like such a good time. I lost my dad 3 months before I got pregnant, and we tried for 8 years to have a baby, and like, that's all he wanted was grandkids. And there's like still so much. It's like every time I look at my son almost, it just like kills me that he's not here for it. And I how grief is, it like fucking hits you like out of nowhere in a wave. And I had one of those waves last night, and that's why I'm like over here like tearing up as you're talking probably too. Because it's just like such good timing. So I want to, and I love these steps, and I'm going to try and use them myself, even though it's been like, almost like a year and a half at this point, or more than that. So I want to talk about the processing the grief one. So what does that mean to really process grief?
That is really a tough question. But it's different for everyone. And this is so important. It was important for my husband and I, having lost our son in a difficult time, to honor the fact that everybody grieves differently and processes it differently. For instance, my husband would go into my son's room every night and just sit. He just would sit there. I couldn't put a toe in that room for 3 years. I couldn't even go in. Everything stayed the same. I couldn't even touch the doorknob. I mean, I just could not go in there. And I asked my husband, please, to, you know, close the door when he was in there and when he was out, because I couldn't even walk by the room for 3 years. So we're different. We process differently, but we had to respect each other. Another thing too is when you're involved in a loss, you can't blame anybody. I mean, especially on a suicide, you know, the girlfriend breaking up is a normal part of life, and you have to do it if the person's not right. No blame in this. You can't blame anybody for whatever's going on. You know, you just have to kind of get that up, because that complicates your grief. If you can kind of get away from blaming, or at least forgiving, if there's someone that did, you know, if there's a murder or something, I mean, that's a little different story. But try to remove blame and remove shame and remove guilt and remove those things. And you know what? You kind of have to take those things one at a time. It's like if you're driving down the road and all of a sudden the shame comes at you and covers your windshield. You have to get rid of the shame and work through that. And driving down again, then the guilt comes, right? And you have to try to work through the guilt. And so much, there's so much guilt involved in so many things. For instance, my husband, he actually kind of died twice, but the first time he stopped breathing for 20 minutes, we assumed he was dead, and he wasn't. And I had taken off his oxygen for a second to put his shirt on. We'd given him a bath. We have a walk-in tub. And he stopped breathing when I took the oxygen off for a second. He was talking to me, and then all of a sudden he was gone. I blame myself. And he was in hospice. I knew he was dying, but all of a sudden I had just killed him. I mean, it crazy. Now he did come back. And then when he finally did die, I had killed him. So I knew that was good. But there's so much guilt that goes around. That's a false guilt. I mean, I knew in my head, if my friend had done that, I said, well, no, you didn't do that. But to ourselves, we're much tougher on ourselves many times than we are in other people that we love, right? So we have to love ourselves enough to give ourselves support, you know? So I think that's part of it. So you have to work through the shame, through the guilt, through the loneliness, through the loss, through the, you know, I want to be with my son. I want to be with my husband, and I can't. He's gone. So you have to kind of work through all those things. And then focus. Part of it is that wise advice that cousin gave me. I have to focus on my living children, because I can't do anything more for the one that's dead, you know? And so, and it doesn't happen fast. It took years. It took years for me to get there. I can do that now. In fact, it's funny because after Eric died, my two daughters, Eric was the one that was going to have the kids. You know how you talk about in your family who's going to have the kids. And we would all joke that Eric would have to marry someone with childbearing hips. You know, that was kind of our big joke, because the girls weren't going to have children. And so when he died, I thought, okay, well, I was a family, we're family of five, now we're family of four, and I only have three other people in my little family that could just completely destroy me if I lost them. You know, I got this little smaller group. And so I'm glad I'm not gonna have grandchildren, because I can't love another person anymore like this, because then I could lose them and then it would go through this again. I can't go through this again. All right. It's all crazy talk, but it's real when you're going through it. And so how wrong was I? I mean, because really, I now have six grandchildren. Both of those girls are not grandchildren. So that just shows you, for parents of, you know, 20-year-olds, this is what they say. But those two daughters each had three children apiece, and the grandchildren are the love of my life. In fact, I'm moving. I live in Minneapolis, and I'm going to move to be part time down in Kansas City, so I can kind of be living there. I'm not in their home, in a separate home. Because there's boundaries, you know, for grandparents. I would be arrested as a stalker if I had my own way. I would be. you get crazy with your grandchildren. I'm going to be available to be there for the little choir concerts they have in their school, and the softball game, and the whatever, the soccer. Even though most of my grandchildren, when they're playing soccer, spend more time looking up at the sky or chasing butterflies. go to the game, right? So I want to be there for them. And they are my greatest source of joy, is my family. And how lucky was I to learn way back when my son died that I needed to be present for them and I need to be present for those grandchildren. Little did I know I would have six grandchildren. I thought I wouldn't have any and I'd have my little group. So grief works. Processing grief is different for everybody. There's no set standard, but the result, the goal really is to have that goal that I'm going to get to a point where I could talk about my son. I could talk about my husband. I could look at pictures. I couldn't look at pictures for years after my son died. I couldn't take pictures for years after my son died. Oh. The only thing I have now that's still hard, I just know I'm just not going to do it anymore, is I can't listen to jazz music because that was his thing. You know, for whatever reason, that still triggers me, but I've kind of gotten rid of all the other triggers. And as you know, there are a lot of triggers when you lose somebody, you know, New York, Columbia. You wouldn't believe, I have a Columbia sports shirt. I'd be at home, you know, I'm feeling pretty good. I'd be looking through my closet. I'd see Columbia on my shirt and I go, oh my gosh, my son is dead. Because when I saw Columbia, my son is dead. Or I saw New York, my son is dead. I mean, all those crazy things that happen to you that you have to work through. It just takes time. And you're not crazy. This is a normal grief process. You just think you're crazy, but you're not. You're just working through.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing all that. It's so true how people grieve differently. And also, like, going back to the stages of grief, it's like, those aren't linear, right? Yeah. Like, they come and go. And like, I feel like I lived in anger so much after my dad died. Like, at the funeral, I was like, I don't want anyone to tell me they're sorry. Like, I said that in the eulogy. And like, I realized, well, so he had a choice. He could have gotten a feeding tube and lived, but he decided not to. So there was like that anger there. It was like, come on, just keep fighting, you know? But I never said that to him. I was like, I support any decision you make, you know? But I didn't realize it was something that made me so angry until like after he was gone. So, I like these other steps though. So find a place for your loved one in your heart. What does that mean to you? Like, how have you been able to do that? And I know maybe tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you have to realize I'm a little bit of an overachiever. You don't really have to go as far as I've gone. With my son, we now have 65 Eric Harms Memorial Libraries all throughout Rwanda. There are over 350,000 books and computers, and there's schools all over Rwanda in his name. We were able to do that, and I've been able to go to Rwanda. And actually, the Rwandans have been my best grief counselors because they overcame a horrible genocide in 1994. And I was able to visit them 16 years later with delivering our first libraries. And I realized here's a culture, here's a whole group of people that survived a genocide. Their entire families were wiped out. They were raped. Their houses were burned down. Everything that you can imagine, terrible thing has been done to them. And yet here they are 16 years later. They did punish their perpetrators. They were in jail, but they realized they were coming out in 20 years and they would have to forgive and reconcile. Now, how do you forgive that? How do you reconcile that? But they realized that if they didn't do that, it's kind of like what I was told when I got the finger in my face. If they didn't reconcile and forgive, their children would grow up in the same environment that they did. And so by doing that, they now have a peaceful country. In fact, I go to Rwanda by myself quite a bit. And my friends go, oh my gosh, you go to Rwanda by yourself? You know, and I say, sure. I said, do you go to Canada by yourself? And they go, yeah, we go to Canada by ourselves. And I said, well, Rwanda and Canada have the same State Department safety rating. You know, going to Europe sometimes, there's some European countries that we visit all the time that are more dangerous, according to our State Department, than Rwanda. It's a very safe country. And here it is, surviving that horrible genocide, and it's surrounded by countries that are not so safe, but they did that work because they thought of their children. And that was such a lesson to me. And so, so Eric's, and I have now with, when Jim died, we've got some dedicated to Jim too. So I kind of had that system. Eric loved books. So did Jim. I talked to my grandchildren and my daughters about both of them quite a bit. They know about their Uncle Eric. And I even have now a grandson, Eric. And for Christmas, for instance, when I give them a gift, it's from Nana and Angel Pop Pop, you know, so I still talk about them. I talk about both of them. And then I also talk to my children about the fact, you know, one day I'm going to die too, and I won't be here. And I want to make sure you need to stay happy, and I want you to have a good life. And Think of me when you have joy in your life, and then that's the best legacy you can leave for me. So I talked to them because I want them to be resilient. I feel that when you're dealing with the suicide, sometimes that resilience wasn't there. For some reason, that resilient part that would help us survive a breakup, which is very traumatic when you're 19. I think that was a missing piece. And so I just have more desire than ever to bring that to my grandchildren and to my other children.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's really amazing what you've done with the libraries. So, and I understand, like, seeing a group who has gone through something, I mean, we don't compare traumas, but like something horrible, and seeing how they've overcome it as a group too is pretty amazing. That they've like collectively been able to overcome that is really inspirational, and it kind of puts things a little into perspective. But why Rwanda? That's so interesting. Like, is there a connection there?
Well, there wasn't. And, you know, when the genocide occurred, I was busy raising my kids, and oh my gosh, this is terrible, just like other tragedies that we see. But right after Eric died, I was sitting at a prayer breakfast, and there was a woman from Rwanda sitting next to me. And she told me about the family that died, her two daughters and her husband that were killed and murdered. And then she told me about her new family, because in Rwanda, the families kind of adopted each other. The orphans were picked up by the you know, mothers and fathers that had lost children. They kind of just reconnected families, and that's what they did. She married another man and adopted two children. Now she has a new family. And
okay, you didn't tell me I needed like tissues with this.
But you can imagine if you had just lost your child, just imagine after your father's death and you're sitting here looking at this woman right in the face who had lost her two, her whole family was wiped out, was murdered. And she is sitting there with joy on her face, because when you're in that depth of depression, when you're in the pit, you don't think you're ever going to smile again. You think, how in the world, I'm never going to be able to have joy in my life. And here she was, just dripping with joy, talking about her new family. And I go, what the heck? And then a couple of weeks later, somebody gave me a book called Left to Tell by Immaculée Ilibagazi, a story about her survival in a bathroom with eight other women when the murderers were all around them for weeks trying to find them. Amazing story. So here I am, Rwanda again. What the heck? And then I had lunch with one of my very dear friends. Her name is Pam Papastanik, and she was on the board of Books for Africa, and she had gone to Rwanda before the genocide. And she said, you know what, I always wanted to bring libraries to Rwanda. Maybe we could, let's start fundraising to send some libraries to Rwanda through Books for Africa. And I said, that sounds great, because Eric loved books. He would go to libraries and pick up their classic literature that they would toss out. He was like a Latin scholar. This kid was And so it just was a perfect way to remember him. And we got started, and we went down to visit Rwanda as these libraries were getting ready to come in. And I just fell in love with the people. When they found out I had lost a son, and the reason I was bringing these libraries was because I lost my son, they just surrounded me with so much love. I can't even tell you the love that these people had who had lost so much. I mean, who had been through a tragedy none of us could even imagine. And yet they were loving me. They were hugging me. They brought me into their circle. And it really was a moment that again, helped me in that healing journey to realize I'm not alone. Because when you go through these things, you kind of feel like you're alone. You know, in your head, other people have suffered through this too, but you feel very much alone. And when you can be with people who have been through, I'm really a supporter of groups, you know, that have been through the same things. When you've been with people that have been through similar things and they hug you and accept you, there is just a wonderful accelerator to your healing when you can be among people that have suffered through the same things.
That's so beautiful. What a beautiful example of just humanity, like the best parts of humanity, right? Yeah. I mean, the fact that you had three different urges, like three different like little hints from the universe or, you know, God or whatever you believe to just kind of go there, like you were meant to go there for your healing. That's really, really amazing. Did you write a book about that? Because you should totally write a book about that.
Well, I've written books. I have one called Naomi and the Widows Club, which is a support group. It's a Christian devotional for widows. It's a whole year to support for widows. And again, I recommend people get in groups with like-minded people that have been through the same thing. And I have that recorded in my in that book, but I also have in my book, Are You Ready? How to Build a Legacy to Die For, which is, you know, once my husband died, I said, well, what do I do now between menopause and death? What's the plan? I don't know what to do because I don't have, you know, I'm not really getting ready for death because you want to pretend that doesn't happen, but you kind of have to. And so I wrote that book. And in that book, I tell my story because your legacy is your life and everything you do, every interaction you have is your legacy. And so I really want to encourage people to start thinking about living with their legacy in mind, you know, not what the world, you know, the world can do for you. What can you do for the world? What can you do to help live with that legacy in mind in every interaction that you have? Because I think that when you do that, when you give love to other people, it comes back. It's like a boomerang. It comes right back and hits you. And it's a win-win. And I think people have to start remembering that again, because it is, it's the key to happiness, as much research has shown, including an 80-year Harvard study. The key to happiness is not monetary wealth. It is the quality of your relationships. And so building those relationships is a legacy everybody can build during their lifetime.
I love that so much. And so is serving and giving, right? Like that brings people so much joy. And I love that. I guess when I kind of read your bio, I was thinking legacy, like, okay, creating your will and stuff. But like, I love that. Like, what are you going to say? So one of my best friend's husbands just lost his dad recently. And I was watching, they live on the other side of the country and I had a newborn, so I couldn't go to the funeral, but I watched it online and I was just like so struck by all of the speeches, and they were talking about what an incredible person he was. And it made me think about that too. I'm like, wow, what are people going to say at my funeral? You know, like what, and no, it's a real thing. Yeah. It's such a great mindset to go through life with.
Yes. And part of that, you know, when you're preparing for the fact that I'm going to go sometime, you do have to get all your financial stuff in order as well, because almost over half of Americans have some sort of conflict surrounding the death of a loved one. And if you can get all of your affairs in order, you know, and write them down so that, you know, if you don't want a feeding tube, if you can say that when you're healthy, so that you're not feeling at the time of your father's death that, oh my gosh, he's making a decision based, you know, his brain isn't quite working because he's, you know, he's in pain or whatever. When you make that when you're healthy, it's so much easier to accept later. And so getting your will in order and making sure that as you divide things up, you're doing it in a way that's understandable, writing letters of intent so that people know. But the biggest thing for me was the greatest love letter of all time was written by Saint Valentine to be delivered after he died. And so we need to write letters to our loved ones. And when they're going through all of our stuff to see, oh my goodness, here's a love letter to me. Here's a letter telling them how much they loved me. You know, my mother loved me, my father loved me. You could kind of speak beyond the grave and including those. So that's all part of that legacy. Legacy is a big thing. And I just want to encourage people to just get it together, put it all in a binder, have it ready to go. And then you can relax and live your life and not worry about it anymore.
Yeah, I love it. And I was going to say, like, as you were talking, you know, if you're lucky enough to like know that something's coming, you can start to get your affairs in order and write that letter. But like, I don't know, then you closed it off, like just get it in a binder and be done. Like there's, you could write that today. And, you know, we talk a lot about gratitude on this show too, you know, just pouring your heart out and thinking about how grateful you are and how much you love the people in your life, like that elevates you to another level, right? And that just brings more of that. Talk about the boomerang, right? That just brings more things in your life to be grateful for.
Yes, and how many children want to hear from their parent how much they're loved, how much the parents were grateful for them,
every kid,
how proud they are of them. We all want to hear that. We all need to hear that. And so you need to say it, first of all. So we live your legacy and say it. And one thing with my son, you know, we had gotten into the habit of saying, I love you at the end of every conversation when we were parting on the phone or in person. So my son, the last thing each of us in our family said to him was that we love him because we were getting off the phone. And you just never know if something's going to happen. Somebody could get hit by a car. And if you know that your last words were, I love you, that really helps with the healing process.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that would be really, really hard if the last thing was like a fight or something, you'd have a lot of guilt and shame to get over. But also knowing that we're here having a human experience, and sometimes that comes with fighting, right? So if you're listening and that's a thing, just like you were saying with the girlfriend. So I want to talk a little bit too about coming to terms with your new reality. And you said something while we were in the green room that was interesting, because you were talking about how, you know, you're a widower and you had to cope with that. But like, there's all these different points in your life where you have transitions, and you pointed out like, now I'm a mother. And then like when your kids are 18 and they go off, and like, you know, I didn't think about it like that. So I'd love for you to just talk a little bit about like, how do you find purpose in these new, like, how do you even like go about finding your equilibrium when things are like so drastically changing in your life?
Well, I think it's kind of like the Warden's task of mourning. I think they're tasks. And when you find yourself as a widow, what happens is, you know, all of a sudden you're alone, and you're not, your social standing is different, because you used to do things as a couple, and now you're by yourself, and you don't always quite fit in with the couples. And then you wonder, you know, where do you fit? What do you do? We all have a purpose, and we all can go out and reach out and help in any capacity we have. And there's nothing that's bigger than another. You don't have to win an Academy Award or, you know, a Nobel Peace Prize. Just, it's the interactions you have with everybody that you have. So there are so many things out there you can do. Get together with people. Find a reason to get up in the morning and to get out, because it's very easy just to stay in, you know, stay in bed or under the bed or somewhere else when you're in that pit. Get up, get out, find a purpose, go out and help somebody else, or go interact with somebody else. And there's a reason that many seniors go down to, you know, the south part of the country, the Florida or Arizona or those places, and have villages where they're all together and they all mingle with each other, and they get out. And I have friends that are down there that can do that. For me, I need to work. I'm a kind of a worker bee. So for me, it was like writing books and doing widows groups and things like that. That was what helped me. But everyone's different. But find your purpose, find what makes you happy, and just get out there and do it. Just do it. That's probably the hardest part, is to do it.
Yeah, that's always the first step, right? Just forcing yourself to take action. Because then as you take action, you know, doorways open up and you meet people and you start to, you know, walk down another path, right? Walk down a different path. So you've gone on to do grief counseling. How has that been as someone? I mean, I'm assuming you had to do a lot of your own grieving before you got there, but is that ever triggering for you? Like, how do you walk that line between being really empathetic and compassionate, but also not getting like totally drained and sucked down by that? Because that's hard too, right?
In fact, when I first got out, I was a grief counselor about 3 years, and then I decided I went into mediation, which is, I'm a grief counselor mediator, now a death doula. So I'm not really actively grief counseling anymore, but I work with widows group, and it's more of a kind of a coaching thing. I kind of consider it, we work as a group and we try to help. And how do we, in my mediation and death doula and grief counseling all kind of came together in that regard, because we have to face it. You know, where do we fit as a grandma, for instance? Where do I fit with my children's families? I mean, I'm there. And like I said, if I had my way, I would be stalking all those grandkids, and there are certain boundaries that need to be maintained, right? So where do we fit? How do we fit within those proper boundaries so that have healthy relationships with our children? We're not feeling left out when they go and have a holiday with the in-laws, because that's a normal, natural thing. It's what healthy families do. And maybe we might feel left out. That's pretty common. So how do we manage that? You know, we need to maybe go and find someone else to go and have Christmas with, or find someone else to go and have Thanksgiving with. All those types of things kind of work together, and just trying to find, what are our new traditions? What is my new daily routine? Kind of work that together and find something that works for you. And also, as you get older, you start to decline physically. So you need to put yourself in a position, move to a place that's going to be safe for a while. Those are all very difficult decisions that we have to make as we get older. And it's been a real privilege for me to help people work through that, because, you know, I'm 68, I'm not getting any younger. So who knows when my decline will come, so that I'm unable to get around as much as I do now. So we need to just kind of be there to help each other out. We're all in this world together. And I think we need to just be there, just kind of help lift everybody up, you know, and get through this as best we can. And I think if we all took that attitude, we'd all be a lot happier.
I love that. And you know, we're all here in this life for a reason, right? There's a purpose we're here. And if you're still here, your purpose is still going on, you know, like you weren't put here in this life to just like wallow in that pit by yourself. So, you know, I love what you're encouraging people to do. How is being a death doula? I've had a couple death doulas on the show. Like I myself was holding my hand or my dad's hand when he passed. And, you know, I'm very comfortable with it, but I think it's a hard thing for some people.
It's an amazing, you know, it's a new thing. So we're just still all finding what we're doing. I was just speaking last week at the Before I Die Festival in Albuquerque. So I was with a lot of other death doulas and I was talking about this, you know, building your legacy, that type of thing. That's what my talk was about. And I was with a friend. We also had a discussion about shedding, helping people kind of downsize. Mm-hmm. And then living funerals versus traditional funerals or both. My husband kind of had both. I mentioned that one time when he stopped breathing, he did come back. We had him for another day. We brought the whole family over. We celebrated his life while he was still there. He had a great time. He was unable to move much, but you know, he had a wonderful day where he was able to see all of, you know, all of his relatives, his children, his nieces and nephews, either physically be there or come on Zoom to say goodbye to him. That was a real privilege. That's so awesome. I think helping people, guiding people through death is a real privilege, just as it would be for a birth doula to help bring in new life. It's they're both related. And it's something that we all are going to go through. And so what a privilege it is to help guide people through calmly so that they're not afraid and help people just in families come to terms with the dying process.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking about this a lot when my dad was dying, like it's a human being. Like they often like don't want to be alone, right? Like having someone there, like, yes, taking care of them and like making sure they're comfortable and stuff, but also just like holding their hand and talking to them or playing music or whatever it is, or talking about memories, like that's really meaningful. And it's interesting, like they say the last thing to go is your hearing. So like, even like if someone is unresponsive, like, you know, being really mindful how you speak to them, and you could still speak to them, right? And they could still feel your touch. So yeah, I think that's really important too, to like guide families on. Have you ever had any kind of spiritual experience being a death doula?
Well, not, I have had some with my own family. One was I had my very, very, very dear friend, my best friend for many years, passed away from pancreatic cancer. And I remember I was in, you know, sleeping at night, and my husband just woke up and to start and kind of woke Kim. And he woke me up and I said, what? And he said, Carol's gone. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, I just saw her. She's here. She just passed through. She's gone. And I thought, oh, well, Jim, you know, no, she's probably not gone yet. And of course, a few minutes later, I got the call that wow, she was passed. So that was interesting. My son, Eric, when he was little, had an experience where he was involved in a car accident. My husband was driving. There were two young boys. One was 17. The driver was 17. He was swerving a little too fast on a windy road after it had just started raining, and he just crashed head on. Into my husband's van, and both he and his passenger were killed during that time. And my son was in the car, and he woke up and he said he saw an angel next to him. And I said, well, what did the angel look like? And of course, he's 8 years old, and his visions of angels have been these beautiful women, you know, in long robes and so on. He goes, well, it wasn't like a regular angel, Mom. It was a man, and he kind of had a big tummy, and he wasn't a regular angel. I said, well, what did he say? He goes, well, Mom, he didn't actually say anything. He told me through his brain. I was like, what? He goes, yeah, he didn't have to say anything. He just communicated with my brain. And he said that dad wasn't dead. He was, because he was passed out in the car. And he said, dad wasn't dead. He was just asleep, and tell him to wake up and get out of the car. And so Jim remembered that this little 8 year old was, dad, you got to get out of the car. You got to get out of the car, urgently telling him that. And then he said, people came and took Eric and put him off to the side when he was 8. And Jim went to try to help the boys. And he said the last time he saw the angel was he was between my husband, Jim, and someone that was in the car behind him who had witnessed the accident. was standing between them as they had realized that the two boys were dead. They got the boys out of the car and they realized they were dead. And he saw the angel between them wrapping his arms around the two men. They were standing there. And, you know, I just get goosebumps when I think of that, this little 8-year-old boy. And then when I started reading a little bit later, Billy Graham has written a beautiful book about angels. And I start reading what the interpretation of angels, which I never really thought about before, that they just look like regular human beings. And you know, exactly as my little 8-year-old son described it, it really gives me a lot of peace. The only thing I had happen to me after Eric died was a very vivid waking up in the morning, and I heard the phone ring, and I answered the phone, and it was Eric, and he said, "Hi, Mom," you know, and any mother knows that you can tell how your child is feeling with the first syllable out of his mouth. You know, you just get that, and it just, like, he was telling me he was in a good place. That's all that I heard. But my husband, again, had several really vivid dreams that were very interesting. And then we had three of Eric's friends that didn't know each other, three different parts of the country, New York, New Orleans, and Minnesota, who had the same dream that he was coming to them after he had died and saying, "Just tell my parents that it was an accident. We didn't mean to do it. Nothing they could have done." So all those things really just helped me to feel that there was a better place out there, and that they're in a better place.
I love those stories. That's especially the story about the angel that came and, like, literally was taking care of this little boy who probably would have been so scared and alone and not knowing what to do otherwise. It's like, your dad's okay. You just have to, like, go wake him up and, like, tell him to get out. Like, that's so amazing. And I mean, I talk about it so much on the show, and I have so many guests like that there's so much more going on than we realize. And there's so much life after we cross that veil of death. Right. And there are ways that our loved ones can reach back out to us. So that's really special. Eric sounded like a very special boy.
He was just an astounding human being. He was noted for his big hugs. He was like a big bear. They called him a dancing bear. He was a drum major at school, and he would be up there dancing around, and just an amazing, you know, and at his funeral, his school, he didn't even go there anymore. They had buses of kids. He was an all boys Catholic. So buses of kids came from the Catholic school to the Baptist church. And he wasn't even there anymore. I mean, he had moved on to college, and they still bus him in the middle of the day for his funeral. Unbelievable. So he was really well loved, and probably made more of a difference in people's lives than, and they even have a memorial for him at Columbia. Like, and who does that? It's a permanent Shad Bush memorial in front of the engineering building. So he made a big difference wherever he went. And that helps me now that I can think about it. After his death, I couldn't, every memory just was painful. But now I can remember him with a smile and with love, and being grateful that I had him for 19 years.
Yeah. And that's so amazing that so many other people saw that in him. I was talking with my husband after my friend's dad died, that I was talking to you about, that he died pretty young. He had got bone cancer and died within, like, I think it was like 4 weeks or something, just like, was totally healthy. But he was, like, such a good guy. And it was almost that, it was like that song, like, "Only the Good Die Young," right? It's like someone that came here and touched so many lives and just was such a pure soul and did so much good. It's like, all right, they've done everything they needed to. They've accomplished it. They've changed the world just by touching other people. It sounds like Eric was one of those people too. Is there anything that we haven't touched on today that you want to, like, really get out there to listeners, like, things, something you really want people to hear and take away?
I think the most important thing that we did cover was just when you're in that grief pit, when you're down in the bottom and you're just sucking up the mud, understand that it is possible. It is possible with hard work, because you kind of feel like it'll never happen. It's just impossible. It's not impossible, but it takes a lot of work, and there's no judgment on how fast you get out, how far you get out. But just keep trying. I just want to beg people to keep trying, because it's so much nicer when you can get yourself out and get that shroud off of your head and have joy in your life again. And it is possible to have joy in your life again.
Yeah, thank you. I know it's probably most people's worst nightmare to lose a child or lose a partner, husband. So yeah, I can imagine it's really hard, but Yeah. You got to like find the joy in the moment, right? You got to keep living your life for the people around you, like you said. It has been such a pleasure to have you on. And I just appreciate your vulnerability and your openness and just your compassion and how much you've shared today. And I'm sure people want to connect with you and know where to find you, know what your books are. So if you wouldn't mind just taking a few moments and just letting listeners know.
Yes, just go to Dr. Kimberly Harms, HARMS.com, and you'll find all the information there and a contact information, and it's all right in one spot. Thank you so much.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much. And if you're listening and there's someone you think could really use this episode, please send it to them. And like, comment, share, subscribe, all the things, and have a beautiful rest of your day. I will see you all next week.